You know,
don't you normally have the Newsoms on one channel?
Newsoms.
Yeah, you know what would be really funny is if as if we did the whole show and the only thing we got is like Kevin and Ryan like responding to what you and I were saying. That would be pretty amazing.
Isn't it?
And not at all frustrating for you.
It would be like a team debate. Is that kind of what
No,
it would
kind of be like Mad Libs. So whoever was like listening to the show, basically they're playing their own thing of Mad Libs. They're like creating their own conversation back.
Sort of like a choose your own adventure, except it never really goes anywhere.
Well, yeah, and it sounds like a lot of work for the audience. I don't know, man.
And all the answers are bad.
It's theater of the mind.
I don't see how
dude.
Any of these analogies really fit into what it would sound like if we had only one channel of
well,
audio.
Well, no, like imagine if you were like a lonely kid.
Have you been
and you were
Britain?
Like listening to the show.
I don't have to imagine, Shane.
Okay, right. Neither do I.
Oh, magic roundabout. I get it now.
And it would be like, you know, you're just sitting like in a dark room by yourself, like on your bed, like under the sheets probably, and those
which
are your
is,
friends
and you're how your, most of the people's people consume our podcast
in a dark
fear?
Room under their sheets
yeah.
but their friends are Kevin and Ryan Newsom and instead of
so
were
the
they instead
friends,
of like
then.
What they would hear me and Mark saying, it would just be them creating their own questions and or responses to what you guys are talking about.
Better yet, we could even send out a script of what you and I might have said. And then they can participate in the
we
podcast.
We can put that online.
And then they can send them back, and we can read the funniest responses on
this
the
week.
Air.
Let's just do. But you know what? One of the things, like that sounds wild. That sounds like an incredibly amusing idea to me and only me. Like in reality, I can't imagine how fucking frustrated producer Mark would be if like that's what happened. If our channel dropped out and it was only two of you guys.
Oh, I kind of like the idea of the hypothetical podcast, though. It'd be like, oh, it could have been so much better.
Name me another show that's done that.
No, no, yeah, like
there's
that's
none.
True.
There's
yeah,
none.
Ryan has a good point, and somebody could just like grab a hairbrush.
It's like Charlie Kaufman created a podcast,
kind of.
Wait, Charlie Kaufman or Andy Kaufman?
Either.
Okay. Right. All right.
One first. One created the other star again. Anyway.
Okay. Let's go into the show. I'm Shane.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Mark.
If somebody likes it.
You know, the 90s was a time of consternation, and two such acts associated with the 90s seem to be at odds. It has been reported that Belle and Sebastian and Noel Gallagher, who never has a harsh word to say about anybody.
No.
Wait, are they in like a rap battle?
Dude, I'd pay fucking tickets for that shit.
Yeah. Basically, so Noel Gallagher, I guess, got a new record coming out, and I guess as part of the conversation along with the promotion for that upcoming release is that he claims that music and culture was, quote, freer in the 90s, stating that it's easier for people to express themselves now. That doesn't totally make sense to me. But anyway, basically, Belle and Sebastian said that he doesn't realize that he's rich and privileged. And that
Stuart Murdoch. Of Belle and Sebastian, or is this just...
Who is Stuart Murdoch?
I think he's the main...
Oh, the main dude of Belle and Sebastian.
Yes.
Right.
Basically...
It was one of those obscure, like, SNL characters
Sebastian
you throw in out of nowhere.
Belle and Sebastian, yeah. And also in Looper.
Yeah, so basically he says, so if you're 20 and you're entering the music business now, you won't know what's gone before, says Gallagher. So for a 20-year-old, I guess this is a 20-year-old in the 90s, you won't realize, but the 90s, it's only now people are starting to realize what a fantastic decade that was for all sorts of things. These are his words for politics, fashion, music, sport. There's a lot of stuff that stood the test of time, Trainspotting, Oasis, Verve, Pulp, all that mob. It was a lot freer then for sure. And Shane has a hand raised.
Two things.
Only two?
Get off my lawn.
No, well, get off my lawn. Okay, well, that was third. But number one, I love how he modestly put Oasis second in the line of things that were incredible in the 90s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I did
like,
that
he put
well.
Trainspotting first, but, you know, like he, and then Oasis second. Like, and then, and the second thing, Yeah, dude, you were in your fucking 20s in the 90s. Like, it fucking rules when you're in the 20s and shit's happening, especially when you were, like, an incredibly famous, incredibly wealthy...
international rock star.
International superstar.
Yeah.
So, fuck you, Noel Gallagher.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. But the other...
I
the
think
thing
he's
that
just
kind
pining
of
get... for the days of, like, the Oasis versus Blur battles, and they're trying to Oasis, like,
course
revive
he,
it.
Of course he is, because, like, he's making money anytime he plays a show, especially in Britain. He's making tons of money, but he's not, like... Noel Gallagher, like in head, you know, like in neon lights. And so, by the way, I, to that end, I think it's very interesting, and I don't think it's contrived, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were, that Liam Gallagher is dropping a record at the same fucking time as Noel Gallagher, and all the news reports I've been reading about are
like brother versus
the
brother.
Gallaghers in the 90s, you know.
Kevin, I believe that that's totally possible. Say again?
You had a point.
Yeah, well the thing that kind of occasionally yeah. the thing that kind of gets thrown away in this article is that Bell and Sebastian announced also that they're releasing three new EPs titled, this is the best part, How to Solve Our Human Problems. So, you know.
Dude, there's a lot of promise in there. I'm waiting with bated breath.
That is a self-help tape I would buy.
That is,
but you don't actually figure it out until the third EP.
Right. Yeah, it's really soft-spoken. And it's like, well, hey, guys, here's what we need to do. Like Michael Cera fronting a Scottish band.
Anyway, yeah, so that's that. The, you know, the Gallagher... Noel Gallagher and Bell and Sebastian.
And Liam Gallagher and Radiohead and, you know, like who actually...
Somebody in Blur and sure.
And the cast of Trainspotting.
Yes, and the cast of Trainspotting. Nobody gets along.
Well, no. Yeah, that's kind of par for the course these days, though, anyway. All right. I was going to say something else, but I can't top that.
All right. Well, let's get the item in hand, dudes.
What are we here to talk about, Shane?
Shane.
Wolf Alice. Visions of a Life.
Second LP.
So let me just say this right off the bat. I alluded to this last week. Their first record is, in my opinion, an instant classic. Like, every song on that record hits. There were probably 12 songs on it, and 10 of those songs are in a different genre. All, you know, kind of based around, like, the four-piece rock, bass, drums, singer kind of thing. But every single one of them could have been a single. So I'm a big fan of the first Wolf Alice record. I think that pretty much that record can do no wrong for me. I love it, love it, love it. And so I had a little bit of trepidation to listen to this one. And first time through, the first couple of songs, I knew I was going to like it, but I didn't know I was going to love it. The hooks were not as obvious to me. But this is one of those records where, like, the third time through, everything clicks, and you're like, oh, yeah, this, like, I get it. Like, for me, personally. It's a lot harder and a little punkier, but, and the hooks are a little lower to get in, but I definitely, personally, I thought it was great.
Well, and one of the things that stuck with me as I was digging through what some other people have written about this sophomore record is that an interesting thing about this band is that they released, before they ever put out their first work, they released a single that kind of got everybody's attention and was an it single for a while, and then they released another single before the first album ever came out, and so in a weird way, like, what has been written is that you know, like, some bands who have a similar trajectory, and I'm trying to think of one, like, there was the... I'm never going to think of the name of this act, but New Kids. Was it New Kids?
The Block?
No, the band from Australia.
Middle Kids.
Middle Kids, that's who it is. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, boy band people. Anyway, yeah, so, but with those guys, it's like, that was the dynamics of acquiring fame were such that it's like they were known for a single and known in Australia before they were known elsewhere. This isn't exactly the same situation, but basically it sounds like there was a lot of their, like, kind of runway that was used up, or that would have typically been used up with these two, like, big hit singles before they ever put out a cohesive work. And then when that cohesive work came out, so many people, a la Shane, really fell in love with it. So it sounds to me like there was kind of a lot of heavy lifting that had to, there were a lot of expectations around this record before it came out.
Well, they were on a ton of festivals too. I mean, like I think one interesting thing about this band in particular. Well, I mean, I say in particular because I like them a lot, but they, you know, the world is different. So we look at, you know, we've talked about this a lot on this show. Like, we don't necessarily look at LPs as LPs anymore. We look at them as like a construction of a series of songs that we either like the one song or we'll pick and choose which songs on Spotify we want to listen to. So, but I think for them, like, where they're...
This feels like a cohesive work to me.
It does, and that's something I want to get to in a second. But talking about, like, alluding to what Kevin just meant, I was going to say, like, I think that where their fame, or fame as it were, you know, however, you know, famous they are, which isn't, you know, that much in the grand scheme of things, came from how many festivals they played in the U.S. and in the U.K. over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. Like, but having said that, yeah, it feels like a record. It feels like a bunch of kids in their early to mid 20s, like, that understand what records are. That's what their first record felt like, and that's what this felt like. It felt like a record. It didn't just feel like a series of songs. I didn't love every song on it, but I loved almost every song.
Well, it's funny. I talked to you, like, right after I'd been listening to it, and I was, like, midway through, like, the third song, and you were like, oh, yeah, that one I'm not all that crazy about, and I'm with you on that one. But I like the vast majority of this record.
That third song, Unconventionally Beautiful, I've kind of come around to it a little bit. Or Beautifully Unconventional, whatever. I've come around to it a little bit. But then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I think the song is After the Zero Hour. It's like, why the fuck they just drop in this, like, Ren Faire acoustic ballad, like, dun, 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 like Green Sleeves, basically. Like, where the fuck did that come from?
And I haven't actually listened to the first record, but apparently it had some of the same deal where they'd kind of switch genres. And I kept noticing that, what's her name, the singer?
Ellie Roswell.
Yeah, she sounds like
Harriet Wheeler.
Well, on some, and sometimes she sounds like Emily Haynes.
Bit of that too.
You know, there are times she's kind of got this bratty delivery kind
of
thing.
Yeah, I was thinking of Justine Frischman a little bit on that first single, Yuck Foo, which, by the
Just
way...
Just a stupid name for a...
We watched one Wolf Alice video a few months ago, and I was telling you, look, this band is fucking great, but they have these, like, funny and, like, air quotations, which I'm doing 3 out of 4 right now because I'm trying to hold a mic, and their videos are not funny, but they have, you know, like, so sometimes they'll have these, like, you know, Yuck Foo, which is a great song.
No, I enjoy the song.
But it's a,
like,
stupid
really?
Fucking name, man.
Yeah, and they probably thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, they think that they, but they're, I think that this... There's a lot of things I have to say about this band, but they one of the things that I think is really cool about them is that they do a lot of different genre. They do a lot of genre hopping. They do it less on this record than they do on their first one.
The other one is Liz Fraser. Sometimes she sounds like Liz Fraser from Cocteau Twins.
Yes.
And it just depends on, like, what, you know, the song calls for.
But I think that's great if you can do it well. If they can pull off the fucking songs. Which I think they... Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we listen to that first single with the stupid name, Yuck Foo, and...
We Shall Commiserate.
And We Shall Commiserate. We watched the video. That was the video where I was that it first came up in my mind, like Justine Frischman, like that kind of, like, little snotty, little sneery.
Yeah, well, that's what I said, bratty.
Bratty.
That's
yeah.
Exactly the song I was talking about. Dude. But we first watched the video where it's just like a photo of the band, like with like strobe lights like flashing on and off, and then it's just the lyrics.
Lyrics.
And it made me wonder, like, is she a preacher's kid? You know, because she's
wait,
like,
why do you, why what?
Because when like when preacher's kids like go rebellious, you know, they say things like shit.
She says, like, I think the line is
maybe
like,
she has Tourette's.
Could be.
That is, yeah, there is always that possibility.
Like, very, like, in rhythm Tourette's.
Mark, you pause this video right now, and, like, she's got a very, like, angry look at her. Like, I feel like she's going to, like, crawl at the TV and, like, hit us with that guitar. Is there, there's something that's very enticing in my mind about a woman playing guitar forcefully, like electric guitar. I like to watch that.
She's a fetching woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something a little bit sophomoric about, like, I don't feel like she's necessarily developed as a lyricist yet, but they're not terrible.
Well, so here's the thing about the lyrics on this record, in my opinion. Like, on the first record, the lyrics were so much better. And, like, I feel like lyric-wise, they were such an afterthought. I've listened to this record a lot. And sometimes they're a little bit, like, embarrassing. Sometimes they're really good.
Well, this song in particular reminded me of Courtney Barnett, like in some of like the
except
delivery
less
style.
Funny.
Well, no, Courtney Barnett. Yeah. Obviously, yeah. She's like a true like Oscar Wilde type wit. You know, maybe not quite as good as that, but you get what I'm saying.
But that's
like,
her forte too. I mean, yeah. Like, she's a lyric writer. You know,
but this is delivered in a similar style to what she did on the last record, and I don't know, like. You know, it's a little bit wanting. So I love the song.
Sure, but I don't think those things are equatable. I mean, I understand what you're saying completely, but like this is one of those songs like you have often said this on the show, like, you know, you turn off your brain and you just listen to the
Oh yeah,
song.
Dude, I love this record actually. But I've been waiting to bring this up, like kind of reminds me a little bit of like early Smashing Pumpkins, which I know you're gonna like roll your eyes about.
No,
like,
no, there's like, a couple. Like, there's a couple Gish, songs
like,
I could
like
see that.
Gish, like I in the what it is to me. And tell me if you think I'm wrong. I've got a couple thoughts on this. I think it's the dynamics. Like you know, like how they it'll build, and I think it's probably done in like,
oh,
the mixing process.
Dude, they are in love with 1993. I mean,
oh yeah, exactly what I was thinking is like if this record had come out in 1992, they would be huge by now.
The only thing that I
and old,
also
yes, well,
and Noel Gallagher would probably be like
Noel Gallagher would find a reason to talk shit about him.
Yeah, so before we go on way down the rabbit hole on old Smashing Pumpkins records, I did want to share
happening.
Like so I found a lot of reading material on this album, and I thought this was. One thing that was kind of struck me as interesting, just from a non-scientific point of view, is that like most reviews of anything that we cover tend to be, generally speaking, pretty positive or pretty negative, and there's very little in between. And the Consequence of Sound take on this album is a decided C. And I was like, that's really interesting. And I was like, I want to see how this guy carves out. Like, how do you carve out a C? And essentially what he said was that that this album felt like, I think in comparison to their last record and then maybe where they're going, like an act trying to find itself a little bit. And I wanted to share just a couple of things here. And then, Shane, I know you're chomping at the bit, so we'll get to that here in just a second. But anyway, he says, when Wolf Alice released Yuck Foo, the first promotional single from their second full-length, Visions of a Life, it wasn't clear if this was a new Wolf Alice, but it was definitely a louder Wolf Alice. Beyond the flippant inversion of the title, Yuck Foo turned singer Ellie Roswell loose, cooing her way through the verses and shouting her way through the chorus. Abrasive by design, the song's most repeated lyric, I don't give a shit, could well be a substitute as a thesis statement for a band in search of itself on its sophomore record. For a band that doesn't give a shit, it sounds like they spend a lot of time trying to give a shit. And like he said that some of the project feels burdened, not as freeing as some of their other work. And that noise is not always a replacement for substance. Now, I know that that's a harder take on it than probably where you guys are coming from, but I thought it was interesting.
Well, I mean, I like I said that right off the bat. Well, this is what I think, number one. Again, this album rewards repeated listenings, and that's just the way where you don't have a lot of time to do that. But, I mean, he's got a fair point. It is a lot harder. It is, but it ultimately boils down to this. The first record they put out is almost flawless. So anything that they put out after that, especially somebody that really liked that record, is going to find a lot of fault in this record. Because
it can't sound like a continuation of your first album,
right? And
like,
it doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, they had areas in that first record that there was some hard stuff. A Giant Peach is a pretty hard song. But you know, like this is going to split. I mean, the AV Club gave it a B+, which is basically an A.
Pace gave it an 8.1.
Yeah,
but he also took time out to say that, like, it kind of sounds like they're spinning their wheels here sometimes.
Right, and I totally get that, and that's what I said in the beginning. But I mean, the thing is like, it's not. I think the reason why people are saying that is because of how fucking incredibly
they were by the
how incredibly good their first record was. I mean, it cannot overstate.
Well, yeah, you and I talked about
genius.
This a few days ago, and I was like, well, you know, you started listening to it, but I really like it so far, and they've been surprising me from song to song, and, you know, so it feels fresh or whatever, you know, aside from the fact that it's 90s, and I don't know that I went into it all that much, but
right.
You were like, you should listen to the first record, and I was like, well, right now I'm going to keep listening to this one, because
I know, which is
I have to
which,
talk about it.
Which is, a smart thing, and that is what he said. It was a smart thing to say. I thought about it later. I was like, yeah, because once you go into their first record, it's not easy. This is a record you have to listen to a couple of times before it sort of locks in. It's a lot heavier.
Well, apparently this band is like super hyped in the last couple of years. Like they've been like the buzz band and they've maintained it for a while. And so, but all I knew about it is that you've brought them up on the show.
Hey, can I ask a question? And this is really sort of just sort of kind of for everybody, but maybe a little bit more for you, Shane. Like, so with albums that, because you mentioned that like this took you probably two or three listens to really feel like you were bonding with it,
sure,
for lack
yeah.
of a better term. So my question is, or at least the thing that I find myself thinking about is like, do we do records that we come to love over time? Do we love those more or less than things that we just immediately fall head over heels for?
I think that's a great question. I definitely don't know that I have the answer to that.
I mean, and I have sort of just one example personally, and it's like it's going to sound nothing like this.
The Gambler.
Yes. Kenny Rogers, The Gambler, is a classic, and I defy any. Anyway, whatever. No. Soft Bulletin, the Flaming Lips record. It's a it's an undeniable classic, and I felt like it was a classic the very first time I ever listened to that album. Uh-huh. But I didn't love it, and I think it probably just has more to do with the fact that I don't really love that band. But
I didn't.
But I think that record is like Sgt. Pepper, amazing.
It's one of the best records ever recorded.
Yeah, totally.
My personal take on it is that these are different emotions. Something that hits you the first time you listen to it, there's something sentimental about it or emotional about it. It strikes something within you. But something that builds on you, you grow to appreciate and love. And I don't know. I don't think that they're
Well, and there's not an empirical answer, right?
Like, yeah, no, but I think that that's a pretty like astute, like as far as I feel about the question.
Thank you.
Like, I think, yeah. Well, you're welcome, Mark.
Mark is greatly gratified.
Let's do another song. Let's do the second single, which I love. And by the way, like I was talking to Skyler about this on the way over here. So it took me a little while to really warm up to a couple of these songs with these kind of like. Almost rap parts, but then all I had to put in my head was, oh, she's rapping like Neil Tennant on West End Girls. And like the second I thought of that, like it just...
Somebody brought that up in a review. I think it was that Pace review.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think that was mentioned.
Really? I didn't read that review. Well, that's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like she's rapping like, you know, sometimes there's a gun in your head, it's one of my mind, you know, whatever. But
it sounds just like him, by the way.
I know.
I want to hear that version.
You know what, by the way? I'm learning how to do amazing impressions from you. Have you noticed the last few shows? I've tossed out a few impressions. All right, can we play this Don't Delete the Kisses song? All right, thanks, Mark. We'll be right back. I'm saying? Like with the Western girls.
Totally. Yeah, I didn't even think of that.
Once you think of it, like it or once I thought of it.
You can't unhear it. Like,
right. But it doesn't make it, I mean, I can hear Western girls a lot.
But that song's got going for what a lot of the record does for me, like with that kind of like that little, and they slowly
they ramp
it
up
in the mix.
The tension.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
I really like that track.
I do too. This is one thing that I wanted to bring up, and I'm surprised you haven't brought it up production wise. Well, number one, this record has a lot.
Did you know who produced this? And I was just looking at the Rolling Stone review, and I don't even remember the guy's name, but it's Beck's bassist.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so that kind of makes it even more interesting what I'm going to say. One of the things that there's something like at first I was like, man, there's something that's really bugging me about this drummer, but I didn't mind it on the first record. And then I realized the drums are buried so way back in the mix. That song we just listened to is Drum Machine. But like for when there's an actual drummer, like they're buried so way back in the mix, and we're used to hearing drums and have a lot of bass response, it kind of bothered me. And then the more I listened to it, I'm like, so they fucked this up. But the more I listened to it, I was like, oh, I kind of feel like that might be on purpose, because if you go listen to a lot of that shoegaze early 90s British stuff, the drums are purposefully put way back in the mix with the bass. Like if you listen to My Bloody Valentine Loveless or a lot of those records.
The guitars are the important thing there, and
right.
You know, the drums are there to keep the beat. But you remember what I called you, like, and we talked about this, and it was probably 3 in the morning or whatever. I just listened to, like
you were saying, it was like Catherine Wheel.
Heavenward, the first track, and I was like, well, cool. You know, I like that kind of stuff. And Catherine Wheel, like, has a, you know, probably I won't even say a toe in shoegaze. It's probably like, you know, a leg. But they're not 100% like
they were like a response to shoegaze. They were like, what if you took shoegaze but made it into a rock band? You know, like the drums were actually really prominent in that band.
So yeah, no, I was real excited when I first heard that, and I was like, well, that's cool. Like, you know, I imagine if the whole record sounds like this, I'm gonna more or less like it. But then they kept surprising me, so no problem with that.
Yeah, no, it's good. Well, do we?
It may be time for intermission.
Do we want to go to the intermission? Mark? Producer Mark?
According to my watch, yes.
Okay. Well, let's do a few minutes with.
These take a long time to cycle because you have to go in the Wayback Machine to get there. That's what the deal is.
What, the video?
Yeah, the video. Anyway, yeah. Hi there.
Oh, I see.
We're talking. We're gonna take a trip back. It occurred to me as I wanted to accomplish two things with today's middle of the show selection. One was I wanted to hearken to some of the tracks that we were listening to from the band that we've been covering. And I also wanted to listen to something that I hadn't heard in a while. And I was thumbing through this book of like 1,000 songs that you have to hear before
1,001.
You die. Is it 1,001? I haven't gotten all
don't
the way through.
Don't forget the last one.
I'm just
dude.
At like,
I
want right to
be the 1,001th artist on that
yeah,
list.
One. Yeah, right now I'm just at like, I don't know, 850. So anyway, but I was thumbing through here and I came across the band Ash, who I haven't thought about in eons.
Neither have I, but I sure did like some of the singles back in the mid-90s.
Yeah, so we're gonna spin one of them. Let's listen to Kung Fu.
Strangers, friends of the match.
So that was Ash. A couple of those guys were roundabouts of 17. And all this may come as a great surprise to you guys, but that song was written by Tim Wheeler, one of the guys in the band, in 5 minutes on Boxing Day 1994 at the Belfast International Airport and recorded in one take the following day on the Verve's equipment with Oasis's producer.
Dude, I was totally going to guess that.
I know. Yeah, I figured.
I was going to say, so that kind of takes away from what I was just going to say. I was like, oh, so that was in the 90s. Let's hear how much No Gallagher.
How much more descriptive of the 90s than what he just said?
I was gonna say let's have No Gallagher pontificate on like how amazing that song was because it was in the 90s. Also, can I say this? I used to wear a lot of Ringer T-shirts in the 90s, and boy, that just took me right back there.
Yeah. So anyway, they said we wanted to write a really crap Ramones song. Wheeler confessed.
Well, they came up with one.
Well, he said it was meant to be a B-side, but it turned out too good.
It was a good song.
Debatable.
It was fine. It was totally fine.
It's serviceable. Yeah, totally.
The crowd in the video seemed to like it.
And here's the thing.
Well, I think they paid them for that, though, dude.
imitating art, imitating life. That actually got used during a blooper reel at the end of the American version of the Jackie Chan film Rumble in the Bronx. Yeah. Wow.
Shane's wife is here.
Oh, my wife's here in the background, like just letting us know
she's
that was
hanging out reading Vanity Fair magazine and
just letting us know that song was in Rumble in the Bronx.
And just like, called that out off no telling what you can't get in your head because that's in there. But anyway, yeah. Yeah, so these guys just sat down and banged out this one song and
in the airport in 5 minutes.
In the airport, well, wrote it in the airport, recorded it the next day.
How do you write
the
a song in the
equipment.
Airport?
Which
as
airport
a band?
Did you say?
That's a really
Belfast.
Good question. Yeah.
About three quarters. I'm not strong in math, but like 3/4 of the lyrics in that song are Jackie Chan's name, right? So, you know.
I'm not saying there was a whole lot of thought put into it.
No,
but
it's great.
No, that's
5
true.
Minutes in an airport.
Anyway, but Shane and I had the exact same reaction when Shane saw what we were going to listen to that was up on the screen. He was like, oh, I haven't thought about that band in ages.
That band.
But I kind of like those guys.
I used to like some of their songs back in the day.
Back when you remember.
You know what that band, even though they sound nothing, I recently heard like a band that was one of their, we're out at the same time as them.
Contemporaries,
right. Thank you, Mark. Smoking Popes. That's another band I haven't thought of in 20
years. We talked about them on the show like maybe a year ago or something.
I know, but that's a lot. Okay,
it was like crooning over like
grunge. Yeah, like that. Right?
I want you around, I think. Was
yeah,
the,
something yeah. like that. Sounds right.
Anyway, I kind of figured that as a few minutes with segments go, we probably shouldn't linger too much on this one because they clearly did not.
Good point.
All right, Mark, you want to take us back?
Sure thing.
We were just talking, like, while we were off the air about how, and I alluded to this before, pretty much I love... Or like quite a bit most of the songs on this record.
You want to briefly talk about one that you're not crazy
about?
But
there's one that I really don't like and I really don't get, and that's After the Zero Hour. And it basically sounds like if someone were strolling down the path at a Renaissance festival and wrote
eating
a song
like...
Eating a giant turkey leg, and then they put it behind their ears so they could write a song on a lute because they just got inspired. Like, I gave my love a... there's something in the...
Turkey leg.
Probably because they didn't have any place to put it because they were trying to write this song. They felt inspired. And so we were talking about this, and
that's a considerable ear if you can put your turkey leg behind it.
Or a small turkey leg. Like maybe it's like...
considerable ear is my new band name.
Yeah, like an ear.
Mine is ergonomic turkey leg.
I was thinking like, it's basically like if your neighbor got really industrious and like your 5-year-old neighbor, instead of doing like a lemonade stand, they like did a Renaissance festival in their backyard. And it
That's
was all
a
like
great
staffed,
idea.
And it would be all staffed by like 5 and 6 year old kids, so they would have like small turkey legs.
Sure.
And you could put one behind your ear.
It'd have to be like the veal equivalent of turkeys. You'd have to like...
What are we talking about?
I don't know. Anyway, at some point I did a Robert Plant impression.
Yeah, so basically Ryan's impression of this song was...
In the darkest steps of Mortar, I met a girl so fair.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
I think maybe a little too much comfort with the singing.
Anyway, I just wanted to talk about that one song because we're not gonna go there or anything, but I highly recommend to anybody that's listening to this record, if we've at all painted a picture where you would like to or interested in listening to it, that's the one you don't have to listen to, in my opinion.
I mean, check it out once.
Sure. Yeah.
But still, overall, great record. You guys did have another song that...
Right.
What
did
we
decide
on?
All right. So Mark and Ryan were saying in the break, both of them had like particular songs that they thought were great.
I like Formidable Cool. Stupid song title.
So...
Great song.
I was thinking, why don't we do this? Why don't we do one? Why don't we do like 30 seconds of one and 30 seconds of the other one? Huh? Because we never fucking do that.
I'm down.
All right.
All right. So let's do that. We're going to listen to two Formidable
Cool. We'll start with Formidable Cool and we'll roll right into Space and Time.
Yes. Okay. Sounds great. He's got you on your knees with that formidable cool. Infected you like a disease with that.
Despite the fact that everybody in the room was talking over the song and I was trying to listen attentively, I still love the song Formidable Cool despite its, again, stupid name.
It's got a stupid name, but can we talk about Mark's comparison to EMS?
I think that's bullshit. And I, you know what? I actually owned that record, Schubert Dip. And I did like the song Unbelievable when it came out, despite its stupid Andrew Dice Clay. Yeah, I know.
Oh.
Yeah, it's very dated now. And I don't think that sounds anything like it.
It wasn't a slight against EMF. I mean,
yeah,
I just...
fuck you, Mark.
See, then it got dark.
Unbelievable.
I thought Space and Time sounds like I bet live that just blows the doors off whatever joint they're in.
Well, I think what they both share, and on Formidable Cool, it's a little bit more prominent, but like, there's really good bass playing on this, and it's like kind of turned up in the mix. Space and Time, like it's you know, somewhat rudimentary, but it serves the song really well. They're both good songs.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah, they're both good songs. I mean, again, like other than like, go to the land of Mordor with the woman with the, you know, whatever.
Turkey leg.
Yes. At the Ren Fair with the flowers in her hair so fair. Yes.
Right, the tiny Ren Fair that your 6-year-old just is putting on. Other than that song,
tiny
like
Ren
pretty
fair.
Much yeah, tiny Ren Fair. Like with flea, like a flea Ren Fair? Like how small would it like
that
what
like
kind of leg
is
what,
dude,
now,
I'm gonna go get investors for the
in
tiny flea Ren Fair
like,
startup
the
company
with like tiny little
sure.
like feathered
some,
caps on
some,
the flea.
Yeah, and we'll do like old like a Sea Monkeys type it's advertisements on the back of comic
right.
books.
What would the turkey leg be? Like what kind of insect would it be? Like
dust mite?
To be small enough to see though. Okay.
Well, no, yeah, you'd have a magnifying glass. I don't know.
Okay, right. No, I got
anyway,
it.
Anyway, I enjoy
like,
both those
songs.
This is
how we're finally making our money.
Exactly,
this is
dude.
Finally paying off, dude.
This is our GoFundMe site, by the way.
So the first song we listened to is Formidable Cool.
Yes.
Which we agree has a less than desirable name. But a good driving song,
and she has like those breathy vocals, you know, and they're still not world beaters lyrically, but like,
No. But it's funny that you're the one pointing that out. But anyway, regardless, that's a good example of another.
And that's the one you knew I was going to like.
Yes, it was the one I knew you were going to like. But it also is a good example of how they effortlessly switch genres, and it does none of the switching feels out of place, you know? Like, they don't do it as much as they did on their first record, but they do it quite a bit where they slip in and out of grooves and beats. And
well, we've listened to a couple records on the show where I was like, well, this doesn't even sound like the same band as the other one. And these all sound like the same band.
They sound like the same band.
It makes sense. Like, they seg well together, but the style is very
styles are different. Yeah. Not to beat a dead horse about the record that we're not listening to, but My Love Is Cool, their first record. It's even more pronounced, but it never doesn't feel cohesive, you know? And that's the same thing on this. Like, it feels like a very cohesive record, even though they switch and change stuff. And there's a lot of stuff that they're doing I really appreciate a lot of the backing stuff that they're doing. Like,
there's a lot going on. It feels like they spent a lot of time in the studio with Beck's bassist.
Why does that amuse you so much?
I don't know, but it just does. They do say his name in the entry, but
I'm just Jeremy something.
I think the production's really good. Like, you know, these guys are doing well. And
I mean, that's not the same thing as,
again,
like,
if it had come out 25 years ago, they'd be doing even better.
If you were saying, like if it were Tiny Tim, like, if that would be something that easily be immune. Like, if Tiny Tim had produced one of Wolf Alice's record,
by the way,
I'm saying so, if he had,
that would be a real feat.
But if he had, that would be
tiptoed to the tulips to come produce this record.
There's a lot of ukulele on the record, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about. So, Ryan mentioned the Paste review of this record, and I do think that the guy who wrote this, the wrap up is kind of interesting. And to that end, going to share a couple of nuggets, because the one that the review that I read earlier seemed to also indicate, you know, this kind of finding your way period that sometimes comes with a sophomore LP. And anyway, this guy at Paste says, while clearly influenced by the high-minded doldrums and restive melancholia of sadness of the Clinton era alternative nation, Wolf Alice never really deserved to be lumped in with the 90s revivalist. Still, what format better suits their polished experimentation, enlightened ambition, and studious genre auditing than ye old college rock? There's no denying visions of a lifetop should have top marks for a sterling sophomore effort. All the same, though, isn't it time they pick a major? So this guy's point seemed to be, like, should there be more focus?
I thought about that earlier today, not about this, but I remember thinking about, like, how many acts in this day and age not only cross genres, but work on think about the people that work in hip-hop, that are in, or work with DJs that are, you know, their day job is a rock band. I mean, you see this all the time. You see people slipping in and out of genres. That's such a fucking dinosaur attitude to have.
Well, and what's
like, I agree. Sorry to interrupt you, and I do want to get back to your point, Mark. But, like, I was thinking about this. Like, it's refreshing to me that a band can be talented at doing a bunch of different things.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Pretty real well.
That's what I'm saying.
This
I mean,
early
like
in their career, and like, who are you to tell them, like, don't do that?
Well, yeah, that it pisses me. I remember distinctly, and not that this is a band that I ever loved, but I remember distinctly reading a review in Rolling Stone when I was in high school about a Faith No More record. That was a band we haven't thought of in a while.
I like a couple of their records.
Sure, yeah, I like a couple of their songs, but. But I remember this reviewer, like, basically the whole review giving them shit for jumping genres. And I remember thinking at the time, like, I like all these songs. Like, I don't need my fucking, you know, like, you know, people
stay in your lane.
People put potato chips in their goddamn chocolate. You don't, it doesn't need to be chocolate. You can do other things and like have and still be like,
that's
oh.
a weird metaphor, but it
but
strangely
you understand
lands.
What I'm saying. Well, I saw some potato yeah. chips and chocolate in there. That's why I was thinking. But you know, like, look, everybody likes Reese's. You know what I'm saying? Peanut butter and chocolate don't have to stay separate from it. You can do a lot of different styles of songs and not get locked into, you don't.
Yeah.
Look,
it's not like they threw
it's just
a speed
dumb
song
fucking
on
idea
here.
To me.
My question
Mark, what
was
just, your, yeah, what was your
my
point?
Question was just like, what is the appropriate rate of change for people that write this type of thing? Because
I don't know. That there
I
is
guarantee
one.
You,
yeah.
this guy has probably written something about another band that like they've gotten old and tired because they're playing the same shit that they've been playing on the last.
You're
100%
right.
Sure.
Well, and, yeah, I mean, that's how an artist and band collective stays vital is they keep. Trying to impress themselves.
Well, but what is that rate of change? There, I mean, I think it's better that they're showing this versatility on one album. They're showing the whole range of things that they can do.
Isn't there also, like, years ago, and I don't have the exact context around this, it frankly doesn't even necessarily matter, but Chuck Klosterman wrote something about the idea that in our 20s, that, like, the idea of being contrary to oneself, like being contrary of expectation, is actually a good and interesting thing. And I like that's kind of what my takeaway is. Like, yeah, like this is it's a great time to experiment. That maybe they don't know where they're going yet, and maybe it doesn't matter.
I mean, that's a great point. And don't you think at the end of the day, like when you're sitting in the studio and you're trying to write the songs together, like you're trying to write a great song. You're not trying to sit there and be like. Is this outside of the genre of the rest of our fucking songs?
That would kill.
If,
throw it out
there if you are, you're a fucking shitty band.
Yeah, you throw it out there and you hope that critics are going to like it. And even more than that, you hope that like the general public's going to like it and people are going to want to listen to you.
But you start from the point where you hope that you're going to like
you're
it
gonna
as a
like
band.
It. Yes.
And then if you write a song that you think are good, you collectively
you
think,
and the three or four or five people around you, like...
If you guys think that song is good, like, far be it for me to say, like, let's you're jumping
that.
All around. Let's pick a major.
Get
you know
in
what?
Your bucket.
Fuck you.
No matter what every song sounds like on your album, somebody likes it.
That's
pretty
what
good.
Happened there.
Oh. And on that
soundbite.
And on that, message somebody at gmail.com. On that one, Kevin, what do you got for us tonight?
No, it's me.
Oh, it's Ryan.
Oh shit, it's Ryan.
It's
that's right. You already
Newsom.
Gave us Ash. Ryan, what do you have?
You're welcome. Well,
yeah.
I'm going to do something unprecedented, but I have never picked a song for the new song, and I was going back and forth because
yeah, you
like,
have a lot of times.
It's just usually they aren't they don't. Fit
I haven't
within
picked
the
a song
year.
For the new song that I've never heard before, but it's by a band that I like a whole lot, and they just have put out some new work. Anyway, it's Queens of the Stone Age. The Evil Has Landed. Song.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
You know what I was thinking about that song? Like it has like that riff kills. And then like the kind of non-chorus is pretty good. And then like his vocal sounds pretty good. But it all just sounds like little parts of a song.
Yeah.
Like
I mean they may not be at their peak. I was just reading
No, I'm saying I'm not saying they're not at their peak. That riff is incredible, but like
you'll just read a little bit of this off.
At a certain point, middle-aged bands reach a level where they no longer need to change. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying, like, the
well,
song...
they're 21 years into their career.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily matter. I'm just saying, like, that song wasn't, in my mind, like, very... Like, there were all the pieces... to put together well into a great song that you're going to love. They just weren't all put together well, you know, like.
I'm with you on that. I mean, I dig that riff. And
that riff killed. That's what was disappointing
there are
about it.
At least like half dozen, look, maybe seven or eight, like Queens of the Stone Age songs that I love.
If I turned that song on, I wouldn't turn it off. But I just felt like they had better,
a little more energy. They back
done,
in the day,
they
maybe?
Could. They just could have done more with a riff that good. You know, like his vocals sound great still. Like, and
they're definitely one of the better bands of the last 20 years.
Yeah, right? they're solid as fuck, man.
Kevin,
I think it sounds better than say. What was that, like, the Stone Roses track that came out, like, years after the fact? Like, you know.
It was it, much, not, it, but, like, but.
Well, Queens
yes.
of the Stone Age hasn't gone away.
Well, I know, but the point is, like, you know, things can go bad. And that
get
wasn't
together
bad, it was fine.
Well, it's like, he's like, let's hold hands and build a wall. That yeah, was, like, that, right. that Stone Roses track.
Yeah, it was like, don't you need one of your hands to build the wall?
That was,
like,
yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, that was bad.
Yeah, anyway.
That's true.
Yeah, but so yeah, it could have gone, you know, things could go more south.
I mean, look,
it's fine.
That song was fine. It wasn't bad at all, but I guess what I'm harping on and what I just want to make a point of is that riff kills. That's a great guitar riff.
So the way that Josh Homme learned to play guitar is like he'd ask his dad for a guitar when he was like 11 or 12, and his dad, for some reason, would only buy him a guitar if he'd take lessons in like some sort of like South
Nunnery?
It was
abandoned
close.
Warehouse.
No, from like in like a, I think it was like a South American style. It was either like samba or bossa
like
nova or
flamenco.
Something.
Flamenco?
But that's awesome. Why he has that idiosyncratic, like sort of, you know, staccato kind of.
He
like,
writes
guitar.
Great riffs.
Yeah,
and he has written a lot, and he's written a lot of idiosyncratic great like melodies and stuff before. I think that song is a decent song. But with a riff that solid, I really would have liked. It sounded
sort of
like he like kind of just gave up on spending the time to write
the
rest of it.
Well, when we had Mark shut the song off, it seemed like he was going into a bridge, and I was like, yeah, I'm pretty much done with it right now.
Yeah, but that shit was 6.5 minutes long, and we quit 3 minutes into it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, solid band.
And not a bad song, you know?
You know, in the pantheon of Queens of the Stone Age, probably a B-minus effort, but they're better than most.
A little bit of a rinse and repeat scenario, you know? It sounded like your average Queens of the Stone Age buyer who's like, hey, I would like something that sounds like most of the rest of their catalog that I don't already own.
Done.
Could be this. That's right.
Well, yeah. Then if that's the case, then yes.
Boom. All right.
Ryan.
Yeah. I've got next week.
Yes, you do.
So, this is going to, like, sometimes we pick old records. Sometimes we pick stuff by newer emerging artists. This is a little bit of both. Was listening to our favorite radio station the other day, KUTX. And I actually called you, Shane, and you go, you picked up after 3 or 4 rings. And you're like, can't talk, I'm playing a gig. And... And I was
I
like,
probably was.
And the question I was going to ask you was, how do we know the name Dream Syndicate? Well, it turns out
they just talked about this because I thought they were Dream Theater.
Okay, which is a totally different thing.
And you told me, one of you two told me, I was like, one of you guys mentioned Dream Syndicate recently. And I was like, I've heard of that band before, but I always thought it was Dream Theater.
I don't think we had that conversation
we
recently.
We did.
I think you dreamed it, dude.
No, I didn't do.
We have talked about it, for sure.
Talked about it, not on the air.
Anyhow, was listening to that, Shazammed it later on, I don't even think I Shazammed it. I called you, and like you were like, I don't know. I'm playing a gig.
Playing a gig.
Yeah. So anyway,
I love how you have animosity
for
that. That's
but I remember
like
the name and
do.
Went home and Googled it, and I was like, so it turns out, they've been around since 1982. They got back together in like 2012, but they were part of the Paisley Underground in LA, which it was known for its jangle pop and also spawned the Bangles. So anyway, they were on a bunch of like reputable labels back in the day, and they just put out a new record called How Did I Find Myself Here? And I really liked the one song that I've heard off it, so I'm curious.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, I will let you do this. As the record,
oh, thanks.
If you will let us, when we do the show next week, just at least play a clip from one Dream Theater
song.
Well,
I believe you have the middle next week, Shane. So.
Dude, oh, yeah, that's up to you, man.
Thank you very much. That is a really great way to solve this problem.
Dream Theater is like part and parcel with Queensryche. Yeah, for anybody.
It's sort of like Rush and Yes and Queensryche, but if you made it just weirder and like the dude played an 8-string guitar.
Great.
Sounds like
that's not what I'm talking about next week. I might have to. I might get hijacked in the middle of it.
That is what I'm talking about.
But it's going to be the dream scene.
Tuned in?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got a lot to unpack.
Question mark.
Yeah, a lot to look forward to. All right, Kevin, get us out of here.
All right, till next week. I'm Kevin.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Shane.
I'm Mark.
This is Somebody Likes It.